Okay, David, this is where we're supposed to choose a side, green or black.
John, my soul is as black as night. Your turn.
I am black for life.
So we're not fighting? I thought this is where HBO wanted us to like pick sides and fight and stuff.
Don't worry, I'm sure we'll find plenty to disagree about on the pod, but we seem to agree on one thing. We both really like this show.
The politics, the drama, the lore. It was made for the lorehounds.
And since we just finished recapping season one, we couldn't be more ready to defend our Black Queen in the Dance of the Dragons.
And with the season pass option in Supercast, listeners can get early ad-free access to each weekly scene-by-scene deep dive, plus our custom show guide with all the characters and connections. See you in the Lorehounds podcast feed each week for our Dragonfire hot, but probably positive, takes.
The Lorehounds House of the Dragon coverage is also safe for Team Green consumption. Side effects may include a deeper understanding of dragon lore, a hardened conflict with itself, and an inescapable urge to read the book Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin. Dragon seeds may experience burning.
Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Rings and Rituals, The Eye. From the Payne and McKay series Rings of Power, I'm Sara, Shield Maiden of Rohan.
And I'm Marilyn, the Librarian of Rivendell, and we're delighted that you've joined us. Today we'll again be reviewing what we mean by ritual, and then applying those concepts to different examples of ritual that we find in this 7th episode of the TV series. We'll explore them using a set of questions to reveal how Payne and McKay depicted the cultures that they were adopting to their series.
Be sure to get in touch with us. A discussion of two is an adventure, but we'd love to have more voices join us. And you can email us at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com, or you can join our Rings and Rituals channel on the Lorehounds Discord. We'll include all that information in the show notes.
And listeners, please take note. Believe it or not, we have only one more episode to cover after today's podcast.
No!
I speak truth here. We've also got a bonus episode, which we'll tell you more about probably next time. We also intend to have a feedback episode so that we can incorporate all the feedback that we get from our final two episodes into one exclusively feedback episode. We must have your feedback by July 9th. Now, that's a fair bit away, so I think it's not impossible, right? Because we intend to record the feedback episode on July 10th. So start thinking about what you haven't yet said that you would like to say and send those in.
Please do. And we also want to say that we are a proud affiliate of the Lorehounds Barovian Broadcasting Network, where you will find all sorts of interesting podcasts on TV, films, books, video games, and other stories. Our thanks to all the listeners who support the Lorehounds and also Rings and Rituals through good ratings on Apple iTunes, which boosts our visibility by joining the Lorehounds Patreon or Supercast and from other forms of donation. Now, if you like what we're doing here, consider giving them a boost as well.
Yes, please. So as our regular listeners know, we like to start with a review of our definition of ritual, particularly for anyone who might be joining us for the first time. Sara, what do we mean by ritual?
So a ritual is essentially a repeated action. It's usually intended to recognize and or bring about change. And it often has symbolic content, although not always, because anything that is a part of like a daily routine can also be seen as ritual, such as walking the dog or cleaning your teeth, or, you know, all of those sorts of things that are part of what we do on a daily basis. So it could be a form of making meaning, which does not have to be religious or spiritual. And I'll give you an example. Fireworks can be a ritual for celebration of many different sorts. Think 4th of July in the US or 5th of November over here, where we celebrate blowing up our parliament. Always fun. And you could also use it to create or reinforce communal identity, although there are also solitary and or personal rituals. But importantly, ritual gives structure and meaning to the unimaginable. And it can also include humor, which can help one to bear the unbearable.
And speaking of humor, I think there was an intent to blow up Parliament. I don't think it succeeded.
Don't break my dreams in two.
I'm sorry.
And if the FBI are listening, I'm just joking. It's okay.
Good idea. So we'll keep these points in mind as we describe each ritual and weave in the following questions. What is the design of the ritual? What is the intent of the ritual? What is the outcome? And particularly, what does it tell us about the culture and the individuals in the culture?
So we're going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, we'll bring you the meat or the tofu for people like me who are vegan or vegetarian without the quail sauce.
Welcome back. We're going to review the ritual elements that we saw in this seventh episode. But to aid our listeners' memories, we'll also include a synopsis of events. Though to save time, we may leave out one or two scenes, or we may compile some out of order for the sake of continuity. Now, please note, we are doing full-on spoilers throughout these episodes. If that isn't what you want, go and binge the entire season and then come back and join us. Besides, for those who are interested, you're probably going to do that anyway, because of something that's going to be dropping on August 29th.
Yes, indeed. So are you starting us off, Marilyn?
Yes, I shall. Galadriel wakens, coated in ash, to strange sounds and horrific images. The air is a thick red fog filled with the voices of people. Galadriel hears Theo and encourages him to follow her. Isildur and Valandil find that Ontamo is dead. The queen tells them to leave his body and help a group of people who are trapped inside a burning building. As the people are leaving, sparks fall on Muriel, blinding her, and the roof falls on Isildur.
I just want to say, I was desperately sad when Ontamo was killed, but he did have a bit of a red shirt on him, didn't he?
I'm afraid he did. I'm afraid he did, with all of his talk with his fiancée about, we'll be back in a week or whatever it was he said.
Bless him, though. He was too sweet to be allowed to live for long.
Yes. Too soon you left us. Too soon. Poppy and the Brandyfoot family arrive at the grove, only to discover that many of the trees have been destroyed by projectiles from the volcanic eruption. Zadok says that fire mountains only wake again when a new evil is rising. The stranger tries to pour healing power into a tree. The Harfoots gather to watch him work, and Nori and Dilly are caught under a falling tree limb. But they are not hurt, only scared. So it occurs to me, I don't know if we've discussed this already or not, but it came up again for me, so I'll bring it up again, if it is again. Is migrating itself a ritual?
Oh, I think so.
Okay.
Yes, yes. Particularly when the kind of migrating the Harfoots do is so linked to seasonal change.
Mm-hmm.
They have a process about their migrating. Everything is done in a very particular way, in a very particular order, at a very particular time. I think that's part of the definition of ritual, isn't it?
Yeah. And it definitely is something that builds a community and keeps it together and keeps it whole. And Poppy's mother's walking song, sung ritually, it seems, because they keep asking for it. And possibly they have been asking for it year after year after year. So,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole idea of walking songs, again, lends itself to this idea of ritual. The bringing together of community, all performing the same act at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And we keep getting hints that there are other Harfoot communities that they're supposed to eventually meet up with at some point. So it's not just this one group that we know, it seems, although, I don't know, maybe their migrating rituals are different, but they're definitely a people that move.
Mm-hmm. And it would make sense that there's more than one group for a number of different reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, one, because you just can't keep intermarrying amongst a small group because, not a good idea.
Bad things happen.
But the second thing is, these are people who live off the land. And if there's too many of them, they're going to strip the land in a very quick time. And there won't be enough food for everybody for the length of time they would need it in each place.
Exactly.
So that does kind of make sense, doesn't it?
Yep. So perhaps Poppy's Badger Brock song, while they're entering into the grove, is going to become a new ritual song.
Right. I like that idea.
And I'm wondering, is it her own song, or do you think it's another one of her mother's?
I like to think it's her own song. Because
I do too.
Yeah, Poppy's of an age now where perhaps this is the sort of time when people start to come up with their own contributions to the community.
Mm-hmm.
But also, let's face it, Poppy is alone now in terms of family. And so she needs to start making her own rituals, her own personal way of getting through the world, if you like. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean she's totally alone in the sense of there's no one around. And we know that she's got Nori's family.
Right.
But that's not the same, is it?
Of course not. How could it be? And in addition to not being the same, it also does nothing to assuage the absence of all those she has lost. I do find it mildly troubling that her song is one about a grandfather in it, or her father inadvertently eating his daughter. But I guess that's just another example of Harfoot humor. What do you think?
Yeah, well, let's hope so. But I like to think that, I mean, what better way to honor your mother, who clearly is somebody who contributed to the community via things like this walking song, by creating a walking song yourself.
That is lovely. I like that very much. Will you carry us to the next synopsis?
Well, it'd be my pleasure, because it's the elves and the dwarves.
Oh!
And I do love Elrond and Durin.
Yes.
Okay, so in this bit, Elrond tries to offer King Durin something sacred from the elves, game, grain, and Eriador timber for the next 500 years, in order to obtain something sacred from the dwarves, Mithril. King Durin asks why they should trust the elves, and Elrond says, in a fit of real honesty, well, they should not. He says they should trust him, because he is half-elven, and he can see in elves that which they cannot see in themselves. The councillors are impressed, but the king tells everyone to leave the room so he can speak with his son. Elrond and Prince Durin both realise this is not a good sign, and they're right. The king says he will not help the elves, because if their time has come, it has come. He will not risk dwarven lives to help the elves cheat death.
Can I just say here, I love the way Elrond has turned what his fellow elves perceive as a disadvantage into a strength.
Yes. I mean, to be honest, it's one of the things that kind of itch at me a little bit. This idea that being half-elven like Elrond is somehow less than.
Yeah.
Particularly when we realize what the other half that isn't elvish comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot believe that the elves of this time would dishonor the memory of Elrond's father and mother in this way.
Yeah.
And yet this has been written in, so we have to work with what we've got. Mm-hmm, and so you're right. It is good to see him take what is clearly viewed as something less than and make it into a strength.
And I cannot imagine in my wildest dreams Elrond ever perceiving that his father is less than.
No.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's absurd. I mean, in effect, Eärendil is the savior of Middle Earth.
Right.
And so what is there in that to be ashamed of? I mean, if anything, you know, he is half elf, half star, if you like.
Yes. I'm going to say, my dad's a star.
Yeah.
That's not something to be ashamed of at all.
Oh, and by the way, he does have one of the Silmarils.
Yes, exactly. So that is something that it causes me problems with this storyline. But as we've said, we're working with what we've got. And so we see him here turning that around and making it into something that he believes actually makes what he's saying more palatable to King Durin. But King Durin is having none of it, I'm afraid.
Well, and I wonder, too, if the showrunners didn't include this particular storyline deliberately, in recognition that there are many listeners and watchers who will have similar life experiences themselves. And Elrond can stand forth as someone who recognizes the strengths of having both of those perspectives so intimately entwined in himself.
That does raise the problematic notion, though, that they first introduced the elves as being condescending towards those who are half-blood.
Well, yeah, and this is the thing that I have trouble with in the Legendarium in general, the way that blood becomes such an important factor, both in the elves, but also Aragorn in the Numenorean line. It is, it is something that crops up in the kinds of stories that Tolkien was drawing from.
That's true. Blood does become a massive issue, but definitely not the issue of what comes out of an elf and human intermarriage. Because the issue of that, in other words, the children from that, mm-hmm. are held up as being something special, not something less than.
Exactly, exactly. And Tolkien makes a great point of that many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, you're right about the rather problematic nature of how he deals with the importance of blood, but that's not one of them.
Yeah, in this instance, no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks. Will you carry on?
Yes, love to, because it's my queen. It is Disa, who is furious. And can I just say, she is magnificent when she's furious.
Oh, she's just a force of nature.
Isn't she? I'm now going to model myself on Disa. Her kind of fury, that's me now. Every time I'm furious, and luckily that does not happen on a daily basis, I'm going to just do a Disa because, wow.
I'm gonna keep my eyes on you and watch for the signs. Step back quietly if I see something about to erupt.
Yeah, she has presence. Well, she's furious and she wants to force the king's hand, but Prince Durin refuses, saying that would be a poor example to his own son. He has a point. The king is the king. Mm-hmm. If you're happy to, just steamroller what the king says and you're the prince, then you're really asking for the prince that comes after you to do exactly the same thing to you.
And you're undermining
and
your own authority.
Disa agrees. Then Elrond arrives, and without a word spoken, he realizes the answer is no. They say a difficult farewell. It's quite an emotional moment, this, actually.
Oh, gosh, it is.
Yeah. And go towards goodness is what they exchange, which is, again, it's a rather lovely moment. It's a touching moment.
The translation of Namarie.
Elrond returns the chunk of Mithril to Durin, only to have Durin and Disa discover the Mithril actually does have a healing effect on the blighted leaf from Lindon. And Durin shouts for Elrond to come back. Okay, so with the elves here, do we see something we could point to as a ritual exchange of sacred materials? Or is this just simple bartering?
The way Elrond presents it, it does feel very ritualistic and hieratic. However, he is the messenger, not the originator. And if I think of Gil-galad, I come to a different conclusion.
Right.
I think he knows the character of the dwarves. I think he knows that, And maybe it is just, simple morality. You don't give something for nothing. And it's very transactional. And he doesn't expect anything less than a transactional exchange. Now, you might have other cultures freely giving between each other, but not in this instance. There's clearly been tension all along, and dwarf-elf relations have not been excellent, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Elrond is presenting it as an ambassador.
Yes.
And he's presenting it as someone who does honor the dwarves and does honor their culture. And yet I don't know that we can call it a ritual, because I don't think anything like this has ever happened before. And one of our key pieces of our definition of ritual is repeated.
Yes.
So yeah. this feels a lot more like a never before and never again moment.
It feels ceremonial.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, but that, as you say, is different to ritual.
Yeah. Yes, ceremony often includes ritual, but in this case, I think he is being very, very formal, as, only both cultures can be. Both elves and dwarves. I mean, think of that lovely exchange over the dinner table. The two of them were utterly polite and oh, no, you go first. No, you go first. That kind of false humility, if you will. And both of them knew exactly what was going on. And,
absolutely.
Saw through each other like a glass window.
Yeah, but the The ceremonial and formal aspect of this transactional exchange is important because this is a request from the High King of the Noldor to the King of the Dwarves. And so it must be made at a certain level to recognize the status of King Durin, to honor that status, whether you like them or not.
Right.
King Durin, in refusing, is not rude, or saying, you know, elves are just awful, and out you go, I don't care about you.
Right.
He asks good questions, like, you know, why should I trust the elves? But this communication with Elrond as the go-between, it feels to me exactly as I would expect this kind of moment to go. With that very formal language, very formal presentation of the request from the High King.
Yes, and the formality is in part to keep any animosity in check, perhaps.
Right, yes, because it's so much better when people are icily polite.
Well, at least you can get to the end of your message without it all breaking down.
Right, yes, it's nice to get to the end of the message without having a knife at your throat.
Or worse.
Okay, do you want to pick up on the next extract?
Shall. Orcs roam the shrouded, desolate Southlands, while Galadriel and Theo hide from them while making their way back to the Numenorean camp. Galadriel tells Theo that the destruction is her fault, but Theo won't believe her. Theo is convinced that everyone he loves is dead, but Galadriel tells him, quote, "What cannot be known hollows the mind. Fill it not with guesswork," close quote. When Theo rejoices that Galadriel has killed many orcs, she replies, quote, "It darkens the heart to call dark deeds good. It gives place for evil to thrive inside us. Every war is fought both without and within. Of that, every soldier must be mindful. Even I, even you," close quote. Theo asks if he is a soldier. Galadriel pauses and turns to look at him and then hands him her sword, saying, "Perhaps we can make one of you yet."
So,
I have to say, this was the point when I really came to love this Galadriel, the whole journey that she and Theo make together. And I'm not sure it could have happened this way if it hadn't been for Adar. And that conversation that they had before, if not all hell, then certainly the mountain broke loose. Because he finally showed her what was going on inside her. And every single thing she says to Theo touches on some point of that conversation. You know, "What cannot be known hollows the mind, fill it not with guesswork," not knowing where Sauron is, not, and she's filling it with all that, well, maybe he's here, maybe he's here, maybe he's here, maybe he's here. "It darkens the heart to call dark deeds good." That's exactly what she's been doing. As was pointed out to her, she was going to commit genocide.
Yes.
And at the nadir of her fury, she was going to commit genocide and make Adar watch her. And she the realization of evil can thrive inside us then. I mean, it just over and over. And every war is fought both without and within. Of that, every soldier must, even I must be aware. I mean, she's really, really having a metanoia here. And being with this young man who could so easily be turned with his grief and his fury to the same path that she herself has been pursuing for who knows how many hundreds of years. She's doing what she can to try and alter that, even though she is also saying, well, maybe we can make a soldier of you.
Right.
What do you think?
Yeah. To me, it is very clear that the moment where she has that conversation with Adar is a very low point for Galadriel, because all of that anger and sadness and fury at everything, it all just vomits out of her when she's faced with Adar. But he really pulls her up short tells her to look in her own mirror.
Yes.
And, you know, I wonder what goes through her head when she walks away there. But it seems to have been quite the realization that she's heading down the wrong path. The other thing that I'd love to point to here is the way in which so many of her words just feel like Gandalf's words from the Lord of the Rings. He comes out with a lot of these sayings. And of course, they're rooted in wisdom. So the Galadriel that we've seen up until this point, a lot of the time she's said and done things that feel very spontaneous and with not a whole heck of a lot of thought behind them, which you can forgive her considering some of the things that happen that she has to respond to. But she's had a bit of time to consider Adar's words. And this is an elf who has been around for a long time already.
Yes.
And maybe this is a turning point. Maybe this is a moment where Galadriel starts to go down the path of wisdom instead.
I think so. I do too. I really think that that is the case. And she, even her face has changed somehow in the upcoming conversation that she has with Theo. I see an expression on her face that I have never seen before in the series. So I think a lot of things are being unlocked and softened and opened up.
Yeah, I've heard of a lot of complaints about the Galadriel of this first series, that she doesn't act like the Galadriel in The Lord of the Rings. And my answer to that was, well, no, of course not.
No.
The Galadriel of The Lord of the Rings is quite a long way in the future. And we all change, right? And even Galadriel is allowed to have an impetuous youth. And she's still, in elf terms, very young here.
Yes.
And she's been through a lot and lost a lot. And we do know, of course, from Unfinished Tales in particular, that she was martial, that she was strong and determined and athletic and skilled. So I like the fact that there seems to be this kind of turning point moment here where we've seen that Galadriel, and maybe now we're about to see the beginnings of the other Galadriel. But yeah, I don't see why the Galadriel that we first see at the start of this has to be exactly the same as the Galadriel in Lothlórien in the Third Age.
I don't think you can become the Galadriel in the Third Age without having had 1,000 or more years of experience of the sort that she is having now. I think what we are seeing is how that Galadriel, Lady of Lórien, came to be. And how she achieved her very hard-won wisdom.
And I'm okay with that.
I am too. I am too. The one piece that I see is lacking at this point is, because you mentioned Gandalf, who of course was a lord in the West, who was a pupil of Nienna. I have yet to see Galadriel grieve. And I think that has to be part of the process. So having, well, I won't mention the teaser because some people haven't seen it yet. But anyway, I think that has to be there at some point before she can have compassion that we see her offer to the members of the fellowship when they first arrive in Lórien, and in particular to Gimli.
Yes. Yes.
So she says, perhaps we could make a soldier of you yet. What have we seen about the rituals that make a soldier amongst the elves, if anything?
Well, the fact that she hands him her sword,
yes,
is so important.
Yes.
Is this part of becoming a recognized and acknowledged soldier in elven culture, that you receive a sword, one that is beyond like a practice sword that you've been hacking around with?
Sure.
Here is now your sword, and you are now a soldier. I mean, ideally, everybody would have that time of practice and training and honing and then become, but someone like Theo has been thrown right into the middle of it.
Yeah,
he's already had to witness death. He's already had to participate in fighting, and he's very young. So it's not ideal. But the way in which she, and it feels very ceremonial, which doesn't may it? Be linked to a ritual that the elves go through in mm-hmm. handing over a sword. This is a sword mm-hmm. of importance because it's being handed down from somebody of great importance.
It's like George Washington's sword. Yeah. If you want to use a US example.
Right.
And think back to the ceremony of laying down the swords that we saw in the very first episode.
And that felt very ritualistic. So if you have
yes.
that kind of ritual of the laying down of swords, surely there is a ritual of the picking up.
Picking up of a sword. Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise, there'd be an imbalance.
Yeah. I was amazed that, you know, Theo took it as well as he did. I mean, I probably would have dropped it with astonishment. Mm-hmm. An elf giving their sword to a human. It was pretty impressive.
Yeah. I mean, even in modern military, there are rituals on yes. passing out and becoming accepted right. as a soldier. I mean,
right.
for example, in the UK, the Royal Marine Commandos, once you have passed all the tests, once you have been accepted as one of them, mm-hmm. you ritually receive your green beret and right. you are shown how mm-hmm. to put it on properly. And there is a way of wearing it. There is a ceremonial moment of receiving it. Mm-hmm. And from that moment on, this is a marker of your acceptance into this elite unit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
And I'm sure that other units have exactly the same sort of thing where
sure.
you're presented with something. It might be the regimental badge or, you know, whatever, mm-hmm, but it's mm-hmm. a ritual. I don't know what it's called in the US, but over here in the UK, it's called mm-hmm. passing out.
That sounds familiar to me. I'm afraid I'm not terribly familiar with military practice, so I can't say for sure. So mm-hmm. listeners, write in. I'm sure there are plenty of you who know the answer to that question. I'm also thinking this is an amazing way to build community, which is, of course, the intent of ritual.
Mm-hmm.
You now know how to set your hat on your head correctly. Right there's a demarcation between you and the rest of the community who don't mm-hmm. know it. Moreover, you are joining a community, all of whom also know how to put that hat on correctly.
Right. And you only get to have that beret if you are accepted into that community. Otherwise, you don't get
right.
to even have the beret.
Right, right. And you've gone through all the exercises and trials and tests and all the rest mm-hmm. of it to demonstrate your ability to take on the responsibilities of that community.
Your worthiness.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. For Galadriel to hand Theo his sword here seems to me to be an acknowledgement on Galadriel's part that Theo has, in some ways, passed some kind of test. In other words, he's gone mm-hmm. through something, he's experienced something and come out the other side in a very similar way to the modern day military rituals that we were just talking about.
Right, right. Which is interesting because I'm not sure Theo would agree with her.
No.
Yet, as an elf with clear sight, I think she sees the potential in him.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Shall I carry on or do you wish to?
Please. No, you carry on.
Okay. So later, Theo asks Galadriel if she has ever lost kin to the wars, and she names her brother Finrod and her husband Celeborn. Theo is astounded to hear that Galadriel can dance, but that was when she met Celeborn, who went away to the wars and never came back. Theo tells Galadriel that he gave power to the enemy, so that makes him responsible for the destruction. And Galadriel responds that this is one way to look at it, but that she believes that the wise also look upon what is in our hearts, and this outcome was not in his. She urges him not to take the burden of this day upon his shoulders because, quote, you may find it difficult to put it down again. He asks how he's supposed to let it go, and she replies that there are powers beyond darkness at work in this world and that they have designs of their own. Theo can't imagine how the loss of his home and his family can be to anyone's design, and Galadriel admits that she cannot see it yet. A group of orcs come, and they hide in silence until the troop passes. So this whole, there are powers beyond darkness at work in this world. This seems to point towards some of the things we see in The Lord of the Rings that we might label providence, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. But of course, for those in the know, she is talking about Iluvatar, the Valar.
Right.
Who they're not present in Middle-earth, but that doesn't mean to say they're not doing things behind the scenes that have some effect upon what's happening in Middle Earth.
Yes, I will admit to getting a little testy sometimes when people talk about the Valar just sitting behind their hills and doing nothing. I just don't think that's the case. I think they're constantly acting. We know that Ulmo is in the waters and occasionally does reach out to humans and bring about some changes. I can't imagine Manwë not taking some, in fact, we know that they do because they send the Istari in the next age to finally contest with Sauron and take him out. So it is important, I think, to recognize that that is built into the fabric of Middle Earth, because as far as Tolkien was concerned, it was built into the fabric of our world. Now, you don't have to believe that or hold with that, obviously, but in the context of the story, it would be astonishing if that was not present.
Right.
And I think this was the thought in her mind when the volcano first started erupting and the pyroclastic flow came towards her and she just stood there and shut her eyes.
Mm-hmm.
My headcanon of that moment is she was handing it over. She was saying, okay, this has gone way beyond my capacity to deal with. I will stand in obedience to whatever you want to send.
Eru, take the wheel?
Eru, take the wheel. Whatever you want to send to me personally, right? I mean, if there were anything she could do to fight it for the sake of everybody, I'm sure she would. But she recognizes this is way over my pay grade. So you have to take it over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And then also the don't take the burden of the stay upon your shoulders because you may find it difficult to put down again. She took on a burden when she picked up that dagger from her brother's body. And she's never put it down yet. In fact, she was looking at it just before Theo asked his question about family.
Maybe slight spoilers for the last episode, but maybe this explains why she's able to eventually hand that dagger over.
I think so. I think we're meant to make that connection.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
So, not a ritual, but still a question. Is Galadriel talking to herself as much or more as to Theo? What do you think?
I really think that she is very inward turned at this point and saying aloud all of the things that she has been learning and giving them to Theo almost as a gift, as if to say, learn from me.
Mm.
And this is the epitome of wisdom.
Right.
Right? You don't have wisdom if you haven't been through it.
No.
Sad but true.
Yep.
It only comes if you have faced suffering. And how much you bring it on yourself and how much it is put upon you, in a sense, doesn't really matter. It's the recognition and the acceptance of the learning that. And it's not about blame. It's not like, oh boy, did I really screw up? No, it's recognizing that your choices have consequences, certainly.
Yes. Yeah.
But also that you can still choose to amend as much as is within your power, you know, lay it down, let it go.
Yeah. Experience is knowing that you've made mistakes. Wisdom is moving on from them. And mm-hmm. not making those mistakes again, if you can possibly help it, and helping others not to make the same mistakes.
Right. And so here in Theo, I think we see her first individual with whom she has been sharing wisdom. I don't think this is the kind of interaction she's had very much, if at all. It was a little bit like when she was talking with Isildur on the ship on the way over. But there it was much more, I don't know, I don't want to say pompous, but because everybody thinks the elves are pompous, but given her centuries of experience and all the rest of it, it's kind of hard not to, you know, feel at least elder to younger, right?
Right.
So, you know, she was sharing, she was starting that image there somewhat because I think something in Isildur also touched her. I think she has her perception from way back in the beginning. It's just, she learns as she ages what it is and how it could be useful and how she could use it to help others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. You going to do the next bit?
I shall. Elendil and other cavalry are guarding the passage of the remaining villagers to the Numenorean encampment. He is looking anxiously for Isildur when the queen appears on Valandil's arm. Elendil realizes that she has been blinded and gives her his horse to ride on. Valandil tells Elendil that Isildur is dead. Elendil confirms to the queen that he realizes that she is blind. She commands them to keep walking, saying she does not wish anyone to notice. Then, going back to the Harfoots, Sadok tells the stranger to walk to Greenwood the Great, where there will be other humans. He gives him a copy of the constellation that the stranger is seeking. As they leave, the tree which the stranger has worked on now shows a single flower blossom inside the trunk, but no one notices. As he heads towards Greenwood, Nori gives him an apple. With no words of farewell, he departs the Harfoot camp. Anything you want to observe at this point, Sarah?
Apart from the idea of giving him an apple, which, you know, it occurs to me there's a lot that is built within the idea of handing somebody something like that as they leave for a long journey. There's a lot of sort of symbolism wrapped up in an apple in that way, isn't there? That it is, yes, it's a source of food, although a very small source of food and not for very long. It's symbolic of life. It is, I would imagine, for the Harfoots, an important symbol of sort of continuation, that they have the food and they go on out onto the road with what they have gathered. Is all a part of their lives. I don't know. I'm just kind of thinking out loud here about that. It just sort of occurred to me as you were telling it.
Well, and the extension of community.
Yes.
You know, you're leaving us, but here, let me acknowledge that, you know, you've been a part of our lives and we've been a part of yours. And of course, if you're familiar with the story of Adam and Eve, you know, you can kind of riff on that any direction you want to go. I will say it was only occurring to me for the first time right now. So I'm not sure how strong the connection that would be there, but for some people they might point to that. I remember when the posters first appeared and
the apple,
all we saw was the apple in her hand. And a lot of people said, Ooh, apple, you know, Adam and Eve. So, but in this instance, I'm not sure that I see it.
We can kind of read into things however we want in the end, can't we?
Oh, yes. It's called cognitive bias. It all depends on what stories are in your mind and which ones you hold to.
Absolutely.
Will you carry on back in the oldest part of Khazad-dûm?
You're giving me Durin and Elrond again?
I am. I'm feeling very generous today.
I know. You are being very good to me. So in the oldest part of Khazad-dûm, Durin and Elrond attempt to open the new seam, even though the rock is restless. They stop to rest themselves, and Elrond tells Durin that he allowed the dwarf to win the right of Sigintarag so that he could talk to him. I think we kind of guessed that, didn't we? Yeah. Each one agrees that the other is much like their own race. Durin starts to tell Elrond his secret name, but Elrond, deeply moved, tells him to save it for the far side. Durin opens a hole into a massive seam of Mithril just as the king, furious, appears and orders the seam to be shut and Elrond to be evicted from Khazad-dûm with his piece of Mithril. The king tries to reconcile with Durin, but is further incensed when Durin says that Elrond is as much a brother to him as if he had been fired in his own mother's womb. Well,
wow.
I know. And he removes Durin's collar of office, telling him to leave it behind because it no longer belongs to him. Deesa is, I'm going to say, a little not happy about this.
You think?
Okay, she's incandescent with rage. And she tells Prince Durin that he will be king and that the Mithril belongs to them. I had Lady Macbeth vibes right then, I'll tell you.
Definitely. I found those words somewhat ominous, to be perfectly honest. And the way they were like doing the glow in her eyes, kind of lighting treatment and so forth, I think I don't really feel the need to be reminded of Disa's fiery nature, but I think they wanted us to go away with that, with it very firmly stamped in our imaginations.
I agree. So go on. I know what you're going to ask me.
Yeah, you do. What did Elrond mean by save it for the other side?
Well.
And Durin seemed to know exactly what he meant.
Right.
But I don't.
No, exactly. I mean, the other side of what? The other side of this problem? The other side of the wall? The other side of the world? I mean, I don't really know, to be honest. I feel like I should have an answer, but I don't. Not really. I mean, there's definitely a sort of a ritual moment here in that the revealing of your secret name, it's a big deal. It's something that you only do to someone who is, you know, so far in your heart that it's the only thing you can possibly do is to give them this most secret part of yourself. And Elrond won't take it. I find that interesting that he refuses it very gently and very kindly, but he won't take it from Durin.
Well, I'm thinking now of Ursula K. Le Guin's Earthsea series and the fact that each person has, when they come of age, they are given a name, which is their personal name, which they do not share with anyone except for those that they trust very deeply. And she even says that knowing someone's secret name can be a burden. And certainly it makes you vulnerable to that person. And I'm just wondering, was Elrond concerned that if at some point there was open warfare between their peoples, would this be viewed as a liability to Durin and to his people? This is just coming up out of my head, so maybe it's a lot of nonsense, but I just cannot make it make sense. Because if by either the side they mean death, I don't think either of them could possibly imagine that they're going to see one another after death, because they have two totally different concepts of what happens to their various races when they die.
So, exactly. There is no coming together after death for an elf and a dwarf. Not in what they believe, not in what their cultures believe happens to them. I mean, we know that for elves, it is laid down that their Fëanor will go to the House of Mandos, and from there will be released back into the world in Hroa, that with all memories and feelings, etc., intact and preserved. And this is the serial longevity thing, right? Which is different to being immortal. Unless you're Fëanor, in which case he's on the naughty step in Mandos for a very, very long time.
Longer than any mortal mind can conceive, I think.
Yes, and so he should be. Yeah. But the dwarves don't believe anything like that.
No. They go to Mandos in separate halls set aside for them, and they just sit and wait until the final battle and the ending of the world, and then they help Aule rebuild it all.
Right, exactly. And it's all about Aule and his provision for them.
Yes.
So it's a totally different system. So the idea of it being on the other side of the, I don't know, curtain of death, if you like, that makes no sense at all.
No. So possibly the other side of the lengthy conflict between elves and dwarves?
Yeah, but that's been going on for thousands of years.
I know, it seems very optimistic, but then we're talking Elrond here, you know? When you consider what his family set as an example for him in terms of holding out hope and so forth. I don't know. I don't think it was anything prosaic like, you know, the other side of the seam or...
Yeah, that would seem a little bit boring, wouldn't it? Yeah, wait until we're the other side of this rock. Then you can do it.
Or the other side of the current crisis that we're in.
That was the only thing that sort of makes sense, but even so, doesn't really.
No.
It feels like a line he was given because it sounds, you know, grand in some way, but I don't really know what to make of it.
No, and the closest we come to what you were talking about earlier was when Legolas takes his dear friend Gimli with him when he sails west, but it's made clear in various places that, you know, only after they got Galadriel's permission and that he wanted to see Galadriel. And so Galadriel talked to the authorities to say, yeah, let's let this dwarf come, because he's a very elvish dwarf. I mean, they do seem to be pulling resonances from that relationship for this relationship.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Even beginning it in a kind of antagonistic way, certainly from the point of view of Prince Durin, and then making it clear that they are, you know, the best of friends.
I wonder if Elrond is possibly imagining that when he sails west, he can have Durin with him.
Also seems really unlikely.
I can't see that.
I mean, at this point in the Second Age, there is no intention on Elrond's part of sailing west anytime soon anyway.
Exactly. Which a lot of other elves have kind of overlooked, forgotten, or never known. I don't know.
Anyway.
We do have one other ritual here.
We do.
Durin disinheriting his oldest son by removing his crest or neck plate or collar, whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
That apparently, I didn't know this until now, designates him as the heir.
Right. So this is clearly part of the ritual of designating you as the heir. You get the neck plate. Mm-hmm. If you're being disinherited, they nick the neck plate back off you. So yes, this is clearly ritualistic. But what an awful moment.
Yes, done in anger and in impulse.
Not a good idea.
Might the king eventually repent and change his mind? I don't know.
I think that
what he perceived as the horrible insult to his wife and to himself, if you think about it, you know, the implication being that King Durin would sire an elf. I mean, I think Durin doesn't know how exceptional he is in his views of the elves and of Elrond in particular. And he's just forgotten it in the moment of his heat and emotion and so forth. And, you know, if he ever needed any evidence that, you know, they're father and son, just listen to them argue sometimes.
Oh, yes.
It'll become very clear.
Yes,
that they
exactly.
They're both closely related.
Incredibly stubborn and very strong-willed. But they're coming at the problem from totally different points of view. And the fact that King Durin is so insulted by the idea of Elrond being a brother of any kind to his son tells you that this dwarf-elf antagonism is baked in.
It is.
I mean, we have a word for that, don't we? It is a form of racism, isn't it?
Sure.
And Prince Durin no more understands his father's point of view on this than his father understands his son's.
Yeah. There is a complete separation there, which is then enacted by this, to me, ritual removing of his crest.
When this sort of thing happens between parent and child, only one really loses out. I mean, it's awful for both sides, but the parent's loss here, driven by the anger and the rather impetuous decision to disinherit his son. Who's the one who's going to be regretting this the most? Because Prince Durin believes he's in the right here and is just going to be angry at his father's disinheriting of him. Yeah, I don't know. I just think that, you know, for a parent to do something like that, one of the things about being a parent is you are the adult in the room and you're the one who's not supposed to lose your rag, right?
Okay. Yeah, not having been a parent myself, I was thinking it would be, you know, equal on both sides, but I definitely take your point.
Yeah, the parent is supposed to be the one with more wisdom. Supposed to be. I mean,
longer,
as a parent, I can tell you that does not always hang true.
Well, yeah, not in all occasions, right? I mean, wisdom is not all encompassing. It's just grievous on both sides, I think. And I'm never comfortable with comparing pain in two people or more, you know, who feels it the most or whatever. It depends on so many things. But I hear what you're saying about expectation of the role and how that can also affect any regret that you might feel.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And it immediately does make me wonder, looking ahead, how this is going to continue to unfold. Didn't even know that Doran had a younger brother, although Disa does mention him when she assures Doran that he is going to be Durin the Fourth.
Well, I just hope he's not called Durin, because then we're going to get totally confused.
That's complicated. That's just a little complicated.
Right.
Shall I carry on?
Yes, please.
Upon waking the next morning, Nori is astounded to discover the stranger's magia has worked not only on the one tree that he healed, but throughout the entire grove, producing more fruit than they've ever seen before. The Hissy sisters find the Harfoot camp that night, along with traces of the stranger on the tree he healed. Nori tries to protect the stranger by telling them that he went a different way from the path that they are following. In return, the trio use their goetia to set fire to the Harfoot camp and disappear. The next morning, Largo insists that whatever the challenge, Harfoots just keep on going, with our hearts even bigger than our feet. Nori decides to go after the stranger to warn him that he's in danger. Poppy, Marigold, and Sadok decide to go on with her. And for once, even Malva agrees. Dear Malva.
I know.
Classic crone figure there.
Right.
Always an opinion, always right, except when she's not.
That's the granny weatherwax of this particular universe.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So somebody is obviously chosen to be the trail finder for the Harfoots. You would assume it would be Sadok all the time, because he's the one with the book. He's the one who, you know, understands the constellations. But it seems that on occasions they can choose another trail finder. But who gets to be the trail finder, and how do they choose them?
Yeah, I found it interesting that the three of them were prepared to go off alone until Malva says to Sadok, you know, they'll need a trail finder. So it seems to be an official position in some respect. Certainly you have to be able to read the documents. And we see a little reference to that in the final episode. One assumes that you're not going to give it, you know, to the youngest Harfoot or, you know, the younglings before they've learned a few things. I don't know if the book gets passed on through family. I mean, like Poppy's mother's song. I'm not sure you could do that, because how heritable is being a trail finder? I mean, all the skills that are involved with that. You have to have a good memory. You have to have migrated on the trail both directions at least once.
And you have to be able to read the stars.
You have to be able to read the stars. You have to know when things appear and don't appear, like when the very first time they saw the humans hunting and then they saw the wolves, and Sadok was looking at something that was incomprehensible to my eyes and saying, well, you know, this has never happened before, that the wolves have come this early or the hunters have come this early. I can't remember the exact lines. So I would assume that some form of apprenticeship or special education would have to be involved. How do you decide who has the right spark? Certainly someone like Nori is constantly curious, but does that mean she'd make a good trail finder? I don't know. She certainly is always often going off on her own, so she has no difficulty doing that.
Right. There's no indication that Sadok has wife and or children, actually.
Not yet.
No.
We'll hear something about that in the final episode. Mm-hmm. And in the final episode, we'll also see sort of a partial answer to this question that we posed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to put in a little PS here, and I hope you'll forgive the indulgence, but this is especially for my colleague, John Lorehound. The large feet of hobbits were basically invented by the brothers Hildebrand, twin brothers Greg and Tim, because of their illustrations. They were one of the very earliest illustrators of The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and for whatever reason, they envisioned all the hobbits with very large feet. And the only reference I can think of in any of the legendarium was to the Proudfoot who put his feet on the table at Bilbo's birthday party. And he was described as having large feet. But to the best of my knowledge, I've never heard of another one. So,
no. And that, it's funny, isn't it, that it's been accepted as canon. Yet, like all other descriptors of character, you can look for it in vain in the text.
Right.
You know, because Tolkien, as we know, was extremely good at describing landscape and weather and all of that kind of thing, and even mm-hmm. insides mm-hmm. of inns. But what he doesn't do is describe characters.
Yeah,
he doesn't say that the hobbits have great, big, hairy feet.
No.
And of course, this was taken by Jackson, and it was exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we got to the Hobbit films, and I won't mention them for long, don't worry.
Oh, thank you.
I don't know how Martin Freeman was able to even walk in those things because they looked like flippers on the end
really
of his poor little legs.
Mm-hmm.
They were ridiculously big.
They really were.
Yeah. They were a little bit silly. Well, there's so much about the Hobbit films that was silly, but don't get me started.
Yeah, we can come back to this.
Mm-hmm. No, please, let's not.
Well, let's
need a whole episode of me just grumbling about the Hobbit films.
No, I meant come back to our text here.
Yes, okay, that's probably a very good idea.
Yes. So will you take us back to the Numenorean camp?
I will, because meanwhile, back at the Numenorean camp, Elendil sets a distressed Beric free, and the horse heads back for the Southron village. Elendil says he should have left the elf in the sea where he found her. Theo and Galadriel arrive at camp and he finds his way to the medical tent where he reunites with his mother and Arondir, and Galadriel asks for Miriel. Bronwyn takes her to the queen, seated atop one of the hills, where Elendil has just told the queen that they can be ready to depart in an hour, and that a garrison will be left behind to attend to their own wounded and to the Southlanders. Miriel tells Galadriel not to pity her, and she swears by the Adunaic name of her father that she will return to confront her enemies, who do not know what they have begun. Galadriel replies that the elves will be ready, but Elendil turns away and weeps. So, what do we see here that we think is ritualistic?
Well, outside the medical tent, which, of course, is where Theo looks first for his mother, knowing her commitment to that skill that she has. I'm pretty sure that these are Numenoreans who are enacting this because their clothing is more formal. You know, their appearance is contrasted with the Southrons, looks more Numenorean. And we see some bodies, shrouded bodies outside the medical tent, and there are people who are smudging them with incense,
mm-hmm.
which also reminded me of the ritual asparagus that the Catholic Church performs with bodies before they're buried. And then she lays a bouquet upon the body. So that bouquet, it was a branch. And I'm just this minute wondering if that isn't sort of a symbol of the branch of returning.
Mm. Right.
And possibly even from the same tree.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to be a callback to that, doesn't it?
Yeah, possibly. I don't know. As I say, it just jumped into my head because, you know, I'm sure they have plenty of herbs they can use, but mm-hmm. This particular one might have that symbol.
Smudging the shrouded bodies with incense, apart from being very clearly ritualistic, is that to cleanse the body in some way, do you think?
I do. Energetically, I mean, to this day, people will smudge themselves with incense as a means of ritually cleansing themselves before they participate in ritual. Perhaps it's a cleansing of the soul for past deeds. Certainly soldiers who were killed in battle would want to be cleansed of any potential evil or wrongdoing that people might perceive in what they did, or what they might perceive in what they did. I don't think it has much to do with, you know, just the fragrance that comes from a dead body. I don't think there was enough there to, you know, alter that in any way.
Too soon, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, exactly.
I presume there would be the intent of taking the bodies of the slain Numenoreans back to Numenor rather than leaving them there.
I can't imagine they would leave them there. I absolutely think they would. Sadly, they'd have more room in the hold, not only because of the lost soldiers, but also because of the horses that were killed.
Yes. And I'm sorry, I'm not laughing at that. I'm laughing because I'm remembering our conversation about what size would these ships have needed to be.
Yes, yes. And the Just Add Water pre-shrunk horses.
Sorry to inject humor into a moment of, you know, important ceremony.
Well, remember what we said, you know, humor helps to bear the unbearable.
Very, very true. And, now, there's something that I found very interesting about this, because Miriel swears by the Adunaic form of her father's name. She says,
yes,
Ar Inziladun. Why the Adunaic?
Yeah.
I mean, Miriel was one of the faithful.
It's a very somber moment and a very frightening one to me because of that switch, of that choice. Mm. She is standing knowingly before people who are definitely on the side of the elves. And Elendil has more, well, I guess that comes a little bit later, but more or less, I think she knows that he knows and he knows that she knows and so forth, that both of them are, you know, secretly loyal to the Valar and to the elves.
Mm-hmm.
And so for her to switch to the Adunaic form, the only comforting thing I could think of was that possibly in present-day Numenor, a vow is not considered to be viable unless you make it in Adunaic.
Because of the, well, we'd be going back to the unfinished tales there and understanding the moment in time that we're at with Numenor, in which we are... we're in a time in which Elvish is no longer being used, mm-hmm. and that the elves are no longer received as friends of the Numenoreans.
They're barely received at all, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's been such a long time since an elf has been seen on the island that when Galadriel steps ashore, she's the cynosure of all eyes, as they say. Everybody is staring at her, and she's not terribly comfortable with it for obvious reasons. So that, again, that just occurred to me now, but I was afraid that it could mean that she is herself beginning to turn away from the path of the faithful, although mm-hmm. next episode, spoiler, we will hear something to the contrary, which I tend to believe is the truth. So it may just be a reflection of her fierce anger and grief and her desire for vengeance. And Elendil weeps. Now, obviously, tears must be close to the surface for him because of he assumes his son is dead.
Yeah.
But is he crying also because this is going to mean further warfare? Is he crying because she uses Adunaic?
It's not clear at this point, is it?
No, or just crying for the loss of it all. I don't know. But I think it's meant to be taken as a very significant moment.
Mm, I agree.
Moving on to another significant moment.
Mm-hmm.
Galadriel learns from Bronwyn that Halbrand has been seriously injured. And I'll just stop here to say it's very interesting to me that Halbrand has not been on Galadriel's mind once, as far as I know.
She's been a little busy.
Yeah. Upon seeing him, Galadriel says that he needs elvish medicine, and so they both prepare to ride to Lindon. Halbrand says that this is not over, that neither he nor Galadriel will abandon these lands to let them burn. Bronwyn leads the Southlanders in a cheer of strength to the king as he and Galadriel walk to their horses. Theo tries to give Galadriel her sword back, and she tells him, "Keep it, soldier." He salutes her, calling her commander, which Halbrand watches with interest. As the two set off, Theo shouts, "Strength to the Southlands." Mm-hmm.
And then we do see this very interesting parallel between what the Southlanders do upon being told that Halbrand is their king and what we saw in a previous episode with what the orcs were doing for Adar, right?
It's a mirror image.
It is. And this is not the first time we've seen mirror image being used to give this, a sort of a significance to something. So here the Southlanders form a double line and they bow to Halbrand, just the same as the orcs did for Adar.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that has to be important. No
Watchers,
spoilers.
Take note.
Indeed. So anything else from that last section that we should note, Marilyn?
Well, there's just a lot there that I'm very curious to see how it's going to all play out. And I had not noticed until this most recent watch the way that Halbrand is staring at Theo. And that's kind of contributing to a number of personal theories that I've been building about who and what Theo will become, but we'll save that for the future.
Well, yes, I think we will have to return to that at some point in the future because it's been noted so often, where's Theo's father? Who is Theo's father? You know, all that kind of thing. So, exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to return to King Durin.
There we go.
Because he has found the completely healed leaf from Lindon's tree, but he tosses it into the Mithril seam, ordering the other dwarves to seal it up. The leaf travels a long way through this seam to land before a... Balrog. And it bursts into flame. And the Balrog is not pleased. Well, would you be? It's like having the alarm clock go off far too early. He was
well, that's an interesting
sleeping.
Image. I just thought he was a real neatneck and was incensed.
Well, there's that as well. Who's just throwing rubbish down? This is my people. This is my bedroom. You know,
hello.
Come on. Rude. So we obviously have that moment of...
No.
Because, you know, it's a Balrog, and those of us who have read other works by Tolkien will have heard the phrase Durin's Bane. Mm-hmm. I'd like to put the phrase Durin's Bane next to the phrase Chekhov's gun, because you can't just have a Balrog and then not do anything with it.
So much as you might like.
At some point in the future, I expect that Balrog to make some kind of appearance.
Yeah,
otherwise,
I think so.
What's the point? So anyway, we leave Chekhov's gun, annoyed at the leaf, because we travel back to Adar. We're in the middle of the ashy red land that he has managed to create. Adar tells his children to take off their outer protective clothes because the sun will no longer bother them. And Waldreg, not a good man. Waldreg leads a hail to our Lord of the Southlands. But Adar says that place no longer exists. While Waldreg leads a chant of Adar's name, we watch the screen as the name Southlands is replaced with the name of Mordor. Southlands was just before Dor.
Yeah, so it's not going to be, I don't know, Eastgate or something like that. I almost wonder why it was felt to be necessary. I suppose there could be viewers who don't know from Tolkien who are watching this for the first time, but I don't know. I guess it was dramatic effect, but
it's
effect. We already knew this, you know. Give us credit for some intelligence, please.
Right, but I mean, okay, on this occasion I might be a little bit on the side of the showrunners because they have to try and find a way to communicate with such a very wide range of people. Those of us who have read Tolkien over decades, have written about his work, have podcasted about his work, have discussed his work, have taught his work, right? All the way through to those people who've never read anything Tolkien. They might have watched the Jackson films and that's it. So I think that they are having to try and find a balance because if they assume everybody has great knowledge of Tolkien, they're going to leave behind those who
don't.
They
can't do that. They can't do that.
And they want to appeal to a vast range of people. On the other hand, if they do too much that is kind of babying the audience, those of us who know a lot about Tolkien are going to be sitting there going, well, that was a bit blooming obvious. Why did you do that? So that is an actual problem for the showrunners that I can understand. Because how do you find the appropriate balance without annoying one extreme or the other?
No, I've appreciated that problem since the beginning. And up until this moment, felt that they had done really a pretty good job of it. Listeners, if there were any among you who had never heard the name Mordor before this or had not made the connection before this, please write in and chastise me gently in a friendly fashion so that I can recognize that, yes, this is certainly a possibility. And it was beautiful script. It was lovely script.
So. Oh, yes. Great calligraphy. Can't fault them on that.
So okay. We do have some feedback. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break now, and then we'll come back.
Okay, Marilyn, I understand we've had some more feedback this week. Is that right?
Indeed, we have. One of which is a wonderfully long and detailed and thought-provoking email by Triangle Walks 91. And I hope you're not too disappointed, but I'm going to save this one for our final feedback episode because I want to approach it fresh and we want to have plenty of time to go into it because there were some lovely details. So that's something for you to look forward to.
Yeah, we want to do that one justice, don't we? Because it really is a lengthy piece Indeed. Of feedback.
It is. So we have a couple of other pieces here. We have Ithrendur. That's how I'm going to pronounce it. If it's pronounced differently, please do write in and correct me. From the PPP Discord, who writes, I really appreciated the insights into Waldreg and the discussion of the different types of magic. Great. Well, good. I'm really glad. We did use those terms in today's episode, so you could see some of the differences actually demonstrated between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah, would you like to take the next one?
Yes. Yeah, so from eHoop via email, and they said, I know I'm way behind, but as I commented on Discord, and thanks for doing that too,
Thank you. I love
that we're hearing about unfinished tales. Oh, me too. I love the unfinished tales.
Yes.
Some scenes I wanted to gush about when you came near the ritual of the heirs of Anarion and the Halifirien in the section headed The Tradition of Isildur. And they are quoting from the text. Isildur gave this counsel to Meneldil, that the king should visit the Hallow from time to time, and especially when he felt the need of wisdom in times of danger or distress, and thither he should also bring his heir and tell him of the making of the Hallow. Of course, the whole scene of Cirion Eol is amazing, says Ehoop, Eol laying his sword across the tomb of Elendil, the words of both, on and on. And the other is at the death of Theoden, which I normally revisit because of the scene of Éomer over Éowyn. And here's the quote, death, 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 death take us all. And they point out this is from the books and not the film. Thank you, Marilyn.
Yes.
But you also have the ritual of Theoden passing the kingship, hail Éomer king, via the standard of the king. My new revelation on this scene is that Theoden King was born in Gondor, mother a classic regal house of Beor-type Numenorean lady, even sharing the name of Turin's mother, which is Morwen, passes the kingship willingly before death, a la Numenor, even if he isn't aging out. I'd like to know if that's mentioned in letters, which I really must review one day. Perfect contrast, Denethor clinging, Theoden passing freely. Great characters. Okay, so do we have a follow-up to that?
Well, this is just really wonderful observation, Ehoop, and thank you so much for highlighting the contrasting deaths of these two kings and reminding those who knew it, but also telling people who might not have known that Theoden was born in Gondor, that his mother was Gondorian. And so there has been this connection between Gondor and Rohan, for quite some time. It goes back earlier than that too, but even just most recently this. He had always planned on passing the kingship willingly. I mean, he does name Éomer as his heir before the battle. And I get, you know, some people might quarrel with, you know, was it willingly because, you know, he was on his last breath and so forth. But I like your point. I see what you're saying. I think it applies. And I do like contrasting those two characters very much. I did do a really quick run through the letters index because you did ask if Tolkien had ever written about this. And there is a reference of something that between the line of kings, Rohan has spoken at the funeral feast and was also listed in the appendix, but it doesn't highlight the willingness of the passing on that way. And he definitely didn't contrast it with, you know, Denethor's taking of his own life. So great observations. Thank you so much for sharing a little more insight with us.
Yes, fantastic. And I too like that contrasting of Denethor and Theoden. Theoden, who seems to be despairing at the start when we first meet him, but then he finds himself again and he embraces the moment and leads his Rohirrim into the charge, his Eored. And his death is, according to the culture, is a glorious one. He dies in battle.
Exactly.
Whereas Denethor, he despairs. And what is it that Gandalf says about despair? It's only for those who see the end without
beyond
doubt.
All doubt.
Beyond all doubt. But Denethor despairs, invoking the heathen kings and all sorts of things along the way.
Yes.
And his death is ignominious as a result.
At the least.
Yeah.
And also, let us say, it must have been very traumatizing for his only surviving son, Faramir.
Yeah.
Because of all the resonances you were just describing.
Yeah. And quite apart from the fact that, you know, Denethor tried to burn Faramir alongside him. Oops.
Well, that too, but we hope nobody ever tells him that. Although perhaps, I don't know, I'm usually one for being honest and open and above board, but, you know, sometimes there are things that I really don't need to know, so.
Mm-hmm. But waking up covered in oil is probably a bit of a giveaway.
Well, that's true, although I don't know that he did wake up. Hopefully they changed his garments before he woke up.
You'd like
up,
to think.
Right? Yeah, particularly in a house that has to use open flame. I mean, come on.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
So thank you again, Ehoop. That was wonderful. And then we have Stephen Rhys Carter from the long-expected Soundscape Discord channel, saying, I just subscribed to Rings and Rituals. Thank you so much.
Wonderful.
We're glad to have you.
Welcome.
I've been looking for more Rings of Power podcasts. Most of mine are just general Tolkien or have gone dormant. So we are not dormant. We are living. We still have a couple more in us, and I hope that you will enjoy them all, Stephen.
Indeed. And even when it might look like we've gone dormant, it's simply hibernation, because we will come back at some point after the second series and do a similar podcast. Just going to give it a little bit of time in between the end of the second series and restarting the podcast. So
yeah,
always look out for us dropping new episodes in the future.
Yes, I could not look upon season one as we have been for this podcast in the immediate aftermath of it. I really needed time for things to marinate and to find the things that I could really connect with. And as I have said before, that Harfoot ritual of harvest was the thing that really drew me in the most. Mm-hmm. and created the whole concept. So
I suspect we won't need to leave it quite as long as we did in between the end of series one and the beginning of us doing Rings and Rituals.
Probably not.
But still, there'll be a little bit of a gap while we gather our thoughts, and then we'll be right back.
Because you will certainly be busy doing week-to-week podcasts as the things drop, and I expect to be doing a few podcasts with the Lorehounds off and on. So you'll have chances to hear our voices if that's what you really want.
Oh, I'm afraid there's no getting rid of us. No getting away from Marilyn and Sarah.
There we go.
Okay, so that's it for this episode. Please write in and let us know what you think. Any suggestions you might have for rituals for us to talk about, and anything else you'd like to share with us. We welcome your feedback. Don't forget, by July 9th, at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com, or on the Lorehounds Discord server, where we have a special channel set up just for rings and rituals.
On the Lorehounds website, there is also a contact form and a voicemail feature. Look for the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We've never had anybody use the voicemail feature, but that's all right. You know, I enjoy reading the written ones that come in.
Absolutely.
And we plan to be publishing every other week from now through July 10th.
So also be sure to check out the other podcasts supported by the Barovian Broadcasting Network, such as Radioactive Ramblings with Aaron and Chase doing Fallout and Invincible, Properly Howard Movie Review with Steve and Anthony, and they're currently reviewing Felonies and Fugazis, Wool Shift Dust with Alicia and her latest podcast, the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, and of course, John and David on the main Lorehounds podcast, currently reviewing Season 1 of House of the Dragon in advance of Season 2 in June, among other goodness. And links for all of these are also in the show notes.
Our thanks to our recording engineer and editor, Bob, to David and John, our producers, and to John for arranging our theme music, as well as all the others who support us along the way.
Now, if you would like to support us and the podcast, please rate and review us on your podcatcher of choice, although Apple really gets the algorithm going in our favor. Mm-hmm. Or find us on Supercast or on Patreon at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Subscribers will get access to ad-free versions of all the podcasts, as well as other benefits.
Until next time, then, remember, only you can show what you are. You choose by what you do. Nakamin. Until we meet again.
How far? Farewell for now.
Okay, David, this is where we're supposed to choose a side, green or black.
John, my soul is as black as night. Your turn.
I am black for life.
So we're not fighting? I thought this is where HBO wanted us to, like, pick sides and fight and stuff.
Don't worry. I'm sure we'll find plenty to disagree about on the pod, but we seem to agree on one thing. We both really like this show.
The politics, the drama, the lore. It was made for the Lorehounds.
And since we just finished recapping Season 1, we couldn't be more ready to defend our Black Queen in the Dance of the Dragons.
And with the Season Pass option in Supercast, listeners can get early ad-free access to each weekly scene-by-scene deep dive, plus our custom show guide with all the characters and connections. See you in the Lorehounds podcast feed each week for our Dragonfire hot, but probably positive, takes.
The Lorehounds House of the Dragon coverage is also safe for Team Green consumption. Side effects may include a deeper understanding of dragon lore, a hardened conflict with itself, and an inescapable urge to read the book Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin. Dragon seeds may experience burning.